From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Here's what we've got today. What would an alternate history of this year's Oscars look like? Well, for starters, it's more black than white. And when director Sam Mendes called screenwriter Christy Wilson Cairns to collaborate on 1917, he finished by telling her an important twist.
And then the last thing he said in that call was, oh, by the way, it's all going to be one shot, which makes my dream job incredibly difficult, I knew right away. And he hung up after he dropped that bomb on me.
And a passionate performance artist takes her concern for the environment onto the stage. It's The Frame. We'll be right back. We now know who was nominated for this year's Academy Awards and who wasn't. There were no women picked for the directing Oscar, and only one person of color, Harriet star Cynthia Erivo, was among the 20 acting nominees. But what if, like Hollywood does in a few movies, there was an alternate history to the Oscars? Franklin Leonard wrote about his imagined Academy Award nominations for the Washington Post. He's the creator of The Blacklist, an annual compilation of much admired but unproduced movie scripts. Franklin, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So, were it not so sad, your column is almost funny. It could have been a satirical piece from The Onion. What motivated it?
Well, I mean, here's the interesting thing, right? Like, it didn't necessarily need to even be read as satire. If anything, you know, the article was written as a list of all of the people who could reasonably have been nominated in place of those who got nominated. And I think that there are additional people that aren't even mentioned in the article who also could have gotten reasonably nominated, and no one would have batted an eye, except for the fact that it would have been unusual that all of the nominees were people of color, that all of the directing nominees were women, which, you know, is so far from our reality only because history would suggest that all of the nominees should be white and all of the directors should be men.
Well, let's talk about that, because there was a lot of great artistic accomplishment from people who weren't nominated. I think about Hustlers from Laureen Scafaria and the star Jennifer Lopez, Lulu Wang, the director of The Farewell, Greta Gerwig, who made Little Women, performances by Alfre Woodard in Clemency, Awkwafina in The Farewell, the entire cast of Parasite nominated for Best Picture. None of the actors were. So what's the disconnect in your mind between the great work and the recognition or lack of recognition of that great work?
I mean, the short answer is racism and sexism and the intersection between the two. I think that there's a fundamental lack of appreciation for the work of women directors and the work of actors of color. I mean, I saw it on my Twitter timeline a bit yesterday, people saying, oh, well, Jennifer Lopez wasn't really acting. She was just playing herself, you know, and I think there's an assumption that, you know, the actors in Parasite are somehow, that's just who they are. They're not actually performing. If you've been in a room with Song Kang-ho, you know that that was a heck of a performance. So I think that the assumptions and the appreciation and the value that we give to these performances and to these directing sort of accomplishments is diminished because of who's doing it. Someone told me, you know, why are you trying to inject politics into these decisions? And it's not that I'm trying to inject politics into it. It's that politics are already in it. I'd like to see them removed, or at least an acknowledgement of the extent to which the politics are already there.
We're talking with Blacklist creator Franklin Leonard about this year's Oscar nominations. Earlier this morning, I read a piece in The Guardian about how award nominations granted to people of color, especially women, are often for subservient roles like slaves, nannies, and maids. And that's movies like 12 Years a Slave, The Help, Babel, even Roma. Do you think there's some truth in that? For the few women and women of color who are recognized, they play a certain kind of part and not another kind of role.
Yeah, I think it's pretty inarguable if you look at the list of women of color that have been nominated and won. You know, I suppose Cynthia Erivo's nomination is progress because she's not playing a slave the entire time and actually is playing a freedom fighter who rescues slaves. But no, I think that there are assumptions by a large percentage of certain demographics of American culture and really sort of Western culture about what role is appropriate for women and specifically women of color. They are far more comfortable with women in those roles than they are if you stray too far afield. And I suspect Jennifer Lopez playing a stripper who gets one over on the men that she's supposed to be dancing for left a significant percentage of members of the Academy uncomfortable.
Since actors are by far the biggest block of Academy voters, why do the Oscar nominations differ from the Screen Actors Guild, which nominated Jamie Foxx from Just Mercy, Lupita Nyong'o from Us, and Jennifer Lopez from Hustlers?
I suspect it's age. I'm not an expert on this, so you can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but the threshold to join SAG is a lot lower in terms of career accomplishment than the threshold to join the Academy. And therefore, it sort of seems inevitable that the Academy voters are probably, at least the mean, significantly older than your average SAG voter. And given the changes that have happened in the industry, particularly over the last 20 years, I suspect that has something to do with the differing nominations.
The Academy, to a certain extent, can only recognize movies that get made, even if Oscar voters still ignored a lot of great work from underrepresented filmmakers and actors. Now, you've worked as a creative executive in Hollywood. So from where you sat on that side of the table, what needs to change in the kinds of movies that are made and who gets to make them so the Academy voters at least can pick from a wider pool of eligible performances and films?
No, I think the same changes that need to be made in any hiring environment where there's endemic bias. You know, we need to hire a labor force that's more representative of the culture as a whole. We need to empower them to tell the stories that they're most excited about telling. We need to make sure they have the resources to tell those stories well. And then I think that combined with the changing demographics of the Academy membership, I think you'd see a real shift over time in what gets awarded. But I think it's really important to remember that, you know, the reason this conversation sort of pivots around the Academy is that that is the time during the year when the industry is most visible to the world. And I think that it's the time when, you know, sort of there the most outside pressure can be exerted. And it's the clearest opportunity to make these cases, right? That no women were nominated for Best Director, it's a lot easier to understand that than it is to understand that 90% of the movies that are directed at studios are directed by men, right? So I think that that's why this conversation happens around this time of year. But the real issue, and the one that matters, is who tells the stories of our time? Do they have the resources to tell them? And do they have the autonomy to tell them as they see fit?
So let me ask you this last question. We know that the Academy, I suspect, is probably a little mortified that only one person of color was nominated in the acting races and that no women were nominated for directors. Is it going to be same as it always was a year from now, 2 years from now? How quickly are we not going to be having this conversation?
You know, I think that at the end of the day, we're dealing with small data sets. And, you know, it takes a long time to make movies, put movies into the marketplace, and then run them through the award season. So, you know, even if everything changed as of today, we probably wouldn't be looking at a major change until 2022. And as we all know, those changes tend to be a bit even more glacial in the industry. So it's hard to say, you know, hopefully within this decade, Lord knows I'm going to do everything I can to make sure it happens faster.
Franklin Leonard is the creator of The Blacklist. His piece in The Washington Post is called "The 2020 Oscar Nominations Didn't Have to Look Like This." Franklin, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Christy Wilson Cairns, the screenwriter of Best Picture nominee 1917. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Over the past weekend, the World War I drama 1917 was a big hit at the box office. Then yesterday morning, the movie directed by Sam Mendes landed 10 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay. The film's script was co-written by Mendes and Christy Wilson Cairns. The two had collaborated before, but this is their first project to be produced. 1917 plays out as a single take. There are no obvious cuts or edits, and because the camera is never ahead of the action, what's new to the soldiers on the battlefield feels like it's new to the audience at the very same time. When Mendes called Cairns to pitch his idea for 1917, she didn't hesitate to say yes.
He had this one image in his mind, and it was based on his grandfather. It was this 17-year-old boy carrying a message through no man's land lost in the fog.
Your orders are to get to the second at Quassy Wood, 1 mile southeast of the town of Bakust. Deliver this to Colonel Mackenzie. It is a direct order to call off tomorrow morning's attack. If you don't, it will be a massacre. We will lose two battalions. 1,600 men, your brother among them. You think you can get there in time?
Yes, sir.
And then the last thing he said in that call was, oh, by the way, it's all going to be one shot. And he hung up after he dropped that bomb on me because he likes to, you know, do things in person. So the questions were saved for our first sit-down meeting.
I guess I have read that right after you got off the phone, you Googled one-shot films.
I did, yeah.
Which probably doesn't get you very far because they're not
really
very
doesn't.
Many.
No, there's not very many. And I was looking for their scripts because, you know, scripts are templates, you know. So I was looking for the formula that one-shot movies would take, like how it would look on the page. So I had to just be like, okay, right, there's nowhere to steal from. You're going to have to make up as you go along.
When you have the device of a single take or what looks to be a single take, it changes the perspective of the audience. The audience, in some ways, is discovering things as the characters because the camera is
yes.
never in front of the characters. What does that mean in terms of storytelling, in terms of the reality that you are creating for the characters and the audience and how far or how far you can't push that reality?
Well, it's very difficult to put it very simply. It's super hard. And like you say, so when you're working in reality, everyone who's sitting in that cinema understands reality. That one shot is how we actually all live our lives. We live it in one continuous, unbroken take. Editing is sort of an artifice in film. And so what we were trying to do was strip all of that away. As a writer, Sam and I had to sit down and sort of be like, well, how far can we push this? How much before it's too much? How kind of like dark and twisted and desperate can you make the audience before they start to look away? Because as soon as anyone looks away, you've lost them.
That's meaning like, the audience might look away if it's too graphic, if it's too violent?
If it's too graphic, if it's too violent, if it's just too much. You know, the way I was, when I was writing this, I had it sort of, in my mind, I had a little kind of like ECG monitor of the audience's heart rate. And I was like, okay, now we've pushed it up so far for so long, people are going to start to fatigue with action. So now you have to drop it back down and make it back into a character play.
Did you hear that story about Wilco? How he lost his ear?
Not in the mood. Keep your eyes on the trees, top of the ridge.
Bet he told you it was shrapnel.
What was it then?
Well, you know his girl's a hairdresser, right? And he was moaning about the lack of...
You have to, as a writer, kind of usually your sole focus is creating a good story that's a blueprint, especially as a screenwriter, that's a blueprint to make an excellent film. That's your job. And with this, there was all these extra burdens, extra caveats. So you were like, okay, because there's not going to be a traditional edit, there's not that final rewrite in the sense you had to then do it in the script. So it becomes really tricky to sort of manage those expectations ahead of time because you're doing it for a phantom audience in your head.
We're talking with Christy Wilson Cairns, the co-screenwriter of the movie 1917. So you have kind of the mathematical challenge of how this movie is going to be shot by Roger Deakins, but you have
yes.
a narrative problem too, and that is, how is the story going to play out emotionally? And how do you try to figure that out as you're writing? Because if the audience doesn't care about these characters, no matter what the technology or the shots look like, they're not going to be in the story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can have the best kind of like cinematography in the world. And I'm slightly biased. I think we do. But if you don't have one or two characters who you root for, then what's the point? And I think that's the case with everything. You know, if you don't have someone in it that you love, someone in it that you feel represents you or your brother or your father or your son, then, you know, what's the point? You know, go and watch a documentary if you just want to learn about the war, or if you just want to see staggering film techniques, you know, watch music videos because they're usually the cutting edge for that. But for us, I mean, the whole point of this story from the very beginning was to make a film that felt like 110 minutes in someone else's life, that felt transportative and immersive. And you could only do that with two characters that you love and you hope they survive.
I want to ask you about research. I want to start by talking about physical locations. When you were walking around battlefields from World War I, what was the physical impression that you took away and how did that shape the movie that you wrote?
I mean, my research in France was absolutely harrowing. I'd been to France several times growing up. I'd gone with my school, I'd gone with my grandparents to the First World War battlefields. And I kind of remember the impression of that being younger, thinking that soldiers were big men, were adults, were grown people who made a conscious decision to go and fight and die for their country. And that last time when I was there, which, you know, was when I was writing the script, so a year and a half ago, I was struck by the fact that, you know, there's a mile of road in just outside Lille, and there's five cemeteries off it, packed full of young men. And I found myself in all of these cemeteries, and I was older than every boy buried there. And I'm 32. I don't feel particularly old. But at 32, if I was a man at that time, I would have probably either been dead or been leading men into battle. And to me, that really hit home the cost of human life, of young human life. And that was something that really went into the script, because it's that idea, you know, Blake and Schofield, George Dean, are so young, and they look very young, and it's quite staggering to think of these young men having to go and live through the unimaginable horror.
I was in London over the holidays, and I took my boys, who are big World War One and World War Two fans, to the Imperial War Museum, and they have an exhibit about World War One that's incredible. And on the top floor, there's an exhibit about heroism. And the personal stories that you encountered in doing your research, because I think you did some research at the Imperial War Museum.
I did, yeah. I spent a lot of time there.
Even though you're telling a fictional story, what were parts of the true life tales that you took away from your research that are incorporated into the story?
Well, what we were trying to do was tell a story that felt completely real. And so we were going through all these different archives, first-hand accounts, soldiers' diaries, because we were looking for sort of these moments that felt filmic but also felt very human and quite profound. One of the ones that affected me most is the milk. So in 1914, there's actually, you can at the Imperial War Museum, you can listen to the veteran himself in his own words telling the story, because it was recorded in the 70s, I believe. And he talks about the 1914 retreat. The British Expeditionary Force were on the run. He stole milk from a farm. And he was a poor farmer himself, and he was racked with guilt at this theft. He wasn't a thief, and he thought he'd taken food out of the mouths of innocent people, of people that were, you know, fearing for their lives. And a couple of days later, he found himself in a cellar during a bombardment, and it was him and a young woman and a baby, and the baby was starving. And the baby needed milk, and he had it in his canteen that he'd stolen a day earlier. And for the first time in the whole war, he felt like he had served his purpose, that he had been there for a reason. And that was really kind of shocking and profound to me, and that went straight into Schofield's character, just that idea of feeling lost, feeling kind of overwhelmed, and then there's just one moment where you're like, oh, I've done a good thing.
Sam Mendes has talked about the stories his grandfather told influencing him. Was there any family story of yours that affected you or that you brought to this film?
My grandfather wasn't born until 1929, so thank God he never had to fight in the First World War. But he was profoundly affected by the war. He grew up in quite abject poverty in Glasgow, you know, and being born sort of 10 years after the conflict, the marks of that generation of lost men was still very much in his life. It was a huge part of him, and he'd lost cousins and uncles in the war, and so he was really shaken by it. And I think for him, even though he wasn't highly educated, he really believed that we had a duty to history, that we as a civilization should learn from the mistakes of our past and hopefully avoid repeating them constantly, and then also we as people should understand history so that we can be better men and women. And he really kind of pushed that on me is when I was younger, the value of learning, the importance of education. And so my love for the war, my interest in that, the First and Second World War, really come from him in a way, which was secondary. So it's not, he never fought on the battlefield, but he was profoundly affected along with the whole generation of people.
Christy Wilson-Cairns is the co-screenwriter of 1917. Christy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Up next on The Frame, record temperatures, global pollution, and animal extinction. It's all part of a new stage show. For the past two decades, scientists and environmentalists have been arguing over a relatively new word, Anthropocene. It refers to the age some people believe we're living in right now, a geological time when human beings are changing the Earth. Think pollution, climate change, and animal extinctions. Multimedia artist Miwa Matrayak explores this perilous era in her new stage show called Infinitely Yours. It's a collage of digital animation, live music, and theater. The Frame contributor Marcos Najara visited Matrayak's studio recently and has this preview.
This actually isn't recyclable, so...
In the back of her K-Town apartment building, Miwa Matrayak rifles through a blue recycling bin.
Can you imagine how many boxes they must have ordered if it has this much broken up bubble wrap and air pillows? Yeah, I'm glad that we're finding this right now so I could pull it out.
So it's like, it's a dual purpose. It's an interview and a recycling intervention.
Yeah.
It's dark out, so she's wearing a light strapped to her forehead.
Is that a spelunking light, Miwa?
Well, I might as well wear this so I can use both hands, right?
Matrayak is sort of the doyen of recycling here in her hood. She often teaches neighbors the do's and don'ts of reusable materials.
I mean, and again, it's not like I'm an expert at this, but like, I know that actual cans, and this is good because it's actually clean, this diced tomato can.
In equal measure, Matrayak hopes her new show called Infinitely Yours inspires people to treat Mother Nature better. But she quickly realized it all starts at home first.
I started to do a plastic audit where I would save everything that would go into the blue bin for a month so I could see it all laid out at the end of the month and like look at the choices that I made in the grocery store and kind of go through my mind like what are the different choices I can make, right? Like going to a place as a bulk bin instead of buying grains in the plastic bag. But also kind of struggling with things like with tofu, how do you get tofu that's not in a plastic container?
Some of the items Matrayak retrieved from the blue bin have become props for her new show, like a plastic bottle she uses to cast beautiful shadows and shapes on a movie screen. Matrayak combines this type of live shadow puppetry with computer-generated animation, and then incorporates her own body to create stunning collages. A projector in the back of a large screen casts the animations she makes in software programs like Adobe After Effects. But that projector also creates a light source for Matrayak to create a silhouette of herself interacting with the images on screen. A second projector in front of the screen adds extra layers of colorful video.
It creates an illusion of sort of like this in-between space of like the physical and real, but also the fantastical. And I think that kind of leads the audience into a place of illusion and transformation and a little bit of magic. Here, I can turn this on.
Behind the screen, Matrayak shows me how she moves herself and a few chairs to create the complex story.
Then I'm having to move these out of the way really fast. And then I have to be here to block the image and have put this back there. I mean, I think there's sort of a riddle of like, you know, the cinematic storytelling versus the theatrical storytelling or theatrical what I can physically do in like real time instead of animation time. So I think that I'll need to make the transition a little bit longer for the Red Cat because right now I'm kind of barely able to do it.
Oftentimes, she's moving behind the screen on her knees or back. She's even learned to walk in a side stretch bend, kind of like the crescent moon pose in yoga.
I've actually gotten accustomed to holding my body like this so that this part of my shadow is the same size, like proportionally the same size as this part of my head. Because if it's here, then my head would be really small. I mean, this is like a small detail, but I think it's the kind of things that I realized through doing this for over a decade.
Matrayak grew up in Japan before moving to California at age 11. She studied physics at UC Santa Barbara before turning to animation at CalArts for grad school. But she's never let go of her love for science, even though she had to let go of its formal study.
Once it got to a level of physics where I didn't get to imagine anymore. It just became like very dry and like math heavy. And it wasn't about like kind of like my big imagination. I think that was kind of led me to going towards art. And again, I feel like I've gotten to a place where I can go back to that and, you know, imagine micro and macro worlds through performance and animation and visual storytelling. It should be a struggle in the process to think about how we are impacting the world. Can I be an educator about this? I'm not sure because I don't come with like a background in, you know, climate change science, but I think there is something to be said about the process and struggle of each person. I think it is important to struggle with our choices and not have those things become invisible.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Miwa Matreyak performs Infinitely Yours Thursday through Saturday at Red Cat inside Disney Hall. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.